Welcome to the Charlatans Podcast. In this episode, we proudly introduced our first guest, Dr. Amanda Hardy, a perinatal psychologist who works with women as they transition from pregnancy to motherhood. In her new book, Dear Mama, You Matter, we explore birth practices in the United States and their negative impacts on women's mental health. We also ask how to best support the mothers in our lives and the importance of changing the narrative on motherhood in American culture. Curl up with your comfiest blanket and listen to what we hope is our most empowering episode yet. Thank you to Cellar Studio 39 for producing this episode.
Welcome back to the Charlatans. Today we have an incredibly special episode. We're having our very first guest. Today we're going to have Dr. Amanda Hardy, who is a perinatal psychologist, joining us and talking to us all about imposter syndrome in motherhood. Amanda, would you like to tell us a little bit about you?
Sure. Thank you so much. It's such an honor. So I am I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I specialize in perinatal mental health. I have a private practice with that specialization. And I'm also a faculty member at a local university in human development and family studies, where my studies have focused on childbirth and parenting and child development and kind of the intersection of those three things. I'm a doula, a childbirth educator. I kind of say I'm like semi-retired on those, but I get to maybe go to about one birth or so a year just because that's such a neat thing to still get to do here and there. And I've worked with several nonprofits, even was part of starting a nonprofit in my own state, and really just looking at, increasing access to evidence-based maternity care and kind of all things surrounding transition to parenthood. So that's a little bit about me.
And what's amazing, too, about this is that we were coming up with topics when we were first developing this podcast, and one of the big ones that Elise and Alyssa wanted to have was about motherhood. And then here comes this perfect, wonderful email from Dr. Amanda Hardy, who specializes in it, and then wrote a book pretty much on imposter syndrome. It was perfect. We're like, yes, absolutely, come on in. And we had to figure out schedules. And with the pandemic, we're like, we will make this happen. So we are so happy to have you here. And I know that Elise and Alyssa, what did you describe it as? Elise, you're very perfunctory. So you have tons and tons of notes ready to go, like ret to go. So let's just dive into it.
I'm excited.
All right.
I'm excited.
Yeah, this book, personally, as a mother reading it, was a very cathartic experience because one of the things that you mentioned in your book, Amanda, is how just about every parenting book focuses on sort of these symptoms of the transition that we don't have any control over, things like sleepless nights, hormonal changes, that kind of thing. And your book really brings it back to all of that's a fact, and those are things that we do need to grapple with, but here's what you can do to actually make yourself, or really empower yourself in this new transition, in this new person you're literally becoming. But we wanted to take the conversation back to the beginning. So, you know, again, we're here. Amanda has a book out called Dear Mama, You Matter. And it's about reinforcing our new identity in motherhood. And we wanted to kind of create the context around the mother's experience with maternity care first, specifically in the United States, because that's where we are. In your book, you state that the United States is in a healthcare crisis, which, I mean, this is so unfortunate, but I mean, this is just rife in every area of our healthcare system right now. But specifically with maternity care, we have some of the highest healthcare premiums and unfortunately some of the worst outcomes, particularly for families of color, as you state. But how did we get here, and what does this mean for mothers?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's a big question. and I think I was very proud of myself in the introduction of the book, because basically that's what I wrote my dissertation on, is mm-hmm. this question of how did we get here? And then the book kind of focuses on like the second part of that question is like, what does that mean for us? You know, cause they're interconnected. But I was very proud of getting that down to as briefly as I did in the book, cause it's a big question. I would really say, I think one of the big things that we do as a culture, and we've been doing for about the last 100 years or so is really this, like, the medicalization, and really even in that, this medical model and what's really called the medical gaze, looking through this lens that is highly medicalized and really highly technological, right? That we favor technology very much over nature, and we believe that technology is superior to nature. And there's a lot that you could dig into. It's called, like, technocracy. You could go down that rabbit hole. But how this really has come into, like, our practice of medicine. And I think what's, to keep it on point with what's really relevant to this conversation, is that I think that a big piece of the how we got here is we really started separating the person, the pregnant person, kind of from their medical experience, right? So instead of, like, you being a holistic person who is having a baby and carrying this child and going to become a parent, instead you are this medical condition, right? And you started to become a chart, you know, and just what tests have you had and where are you at in these things, rather than, like, seeing that holistic being. So I would say that's my summary of what I think has been a big part, is really, like, separating those two things out, which is really, I think, not, is true of a lot of areas of maybe how we're practicing medicine, but very much so in maternity care, right? Like, mom became a vessel for the baby. And right there, that kind of, like, separation, you can see how that can very much carry over into maybe some of this more motherhood stuff that we're going to talk about here a little bit. But I would say that's the relevant piece.
Yeah. And I feel like that experience of separation of the mother from the baby, or the mother from her experience as a pregnant person. Yeah. It carries into how you can view your child even after you give birth, which is crazy. So your first experiences with motherhood is this, like, separation. Mm-hmm. Do I even belong in this, this role? Yeah. So that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's huge. And I don't think that we pay enough attention to that as a culture, like, to that impact. Mm-hmm. And I would say, like, to what you're saying, like, Alyssa, and I think I've heard this from so many moms, and, like, this came up so much in the research, is that very much a kind of an out-of-body experience, and the, like, yeah, I don't belong here. And this, like, click, this all just became about the baby. And really, from a lot of times, most people would say in pregnancy, you know, and so really, and that's the title of the book, right? Dear Mama, You Matter, because that question that we internalize of, do I even matter in this room? This is all about the baby, and that's the only thing that matters, just gets repeated and repeated. And I think we internalize that, and it can start to cause some wounds there. And depending on various circumstances and various histories, yeah, do I even matter here? Do I even belong here? Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many friends that we've had or we ourselves have had, where we go up to people and people are like, oh, how's the baby doing? And then you get the answer of how the baby's doing.
Yep.
And then that's it. Other than, hey, how are you doing? Oh, the baby's really cranky at night, aren't they? And then that's all you get. Mm-hmm. It's not about, how are you healing? Do you need any help with anything? Has there been a good shift in roles? Do you need anything else? It's, again, I love what you said about women being a chart as soon as they walk in. You know, that's such a true experience for so many women.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that kind of ties into our next question, too. During this time, you talk about, like, the power play between patient and doctors, right? Is that as the pregnant woman, you're coming in and you are not the professional in this field. So you feel like you have to listen to the professional, right? You're internalizing this dynamic. Well, this person's supposed to know better, so I need to listen to them. And I know that was part of my experience. A point you made in your book is that after you have a baby, you should feel empowered. You should feel like you are cresting Mount Everest. And to me, it was like, I'm so type A. I came in and I did my job. You wanted me to push a baby out. I pushed a baby out and here's a baby. It wasn't this, holy hell, what did I just do? Mm-hmm. Like, look at my moment. And it came in with this self-doubt of, what do I kind of do now? I gave you all of my control.
Yeah.
So how does this encounter between the medical field and ourselves impact a person's ability to navigate the challenges of pregnancy and motherhood effectively?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, a little bit what I was kind of saying earlier is this idea that that question of like, do I matter? And even just that idea of like, I mean, just the simple idea of like, being pregnant and having a baby is a medical event, rather than being framed as like actually just a physiological response to a physiological ability of the body to birth, right? Like right now I'm breathing in and out, in and out. It's just a physiological thing in my body. And we assume that that's just going to keep happening the way that it would, because that's what my lungs do, right? And like the idea that like that's what the uterus does, it can grow, house, and birth children. But the fact that we frame it in this medical way and kind of that, again, that detachment from the body, I think that as we internalize that idea, we question ourselves, right? We question, can I do this without some type of expert intervention? And I think you use the word, you know, it really can start those seeds of self-doubt of, you know, and then especially let's throw in if things get very complicated, right? And how you feel even maybe more detached from your experiences and more like I need experts to accomplish this thing. And I think that that can really influence how we view things when we hit hard days, which we're going to hit hard days. And so I think that how we go through those experiences and kind of feeling detached and like we need the experts. So it's not to devalue that there is absolutely a role of experts, but that we need them to be okay can really influence, I think, how we face future challenges.
That's so well said. That is so well said. And I'm just so glad, I'm just popping back, that we have a doctor on the podcast right now, because I want to just start clapping and like cheering because it's just everything that we've heard anecdotally just put into factual evidence and just everything you gathered from your expertise. So this is amazing. And I know we're about to go into a really interesting section now too. I think Elise had a really good point on that.
Well, this is something about your book that you do so well. You break down the like science side of everything that we do need. We need this information. We need to know what's happening. We need to be aware of that. But you also put it into terms that is like, all right, science aside, here's what that looks like for us in our daily life. This is kind of where that change and growth happens. And so your book talks about this concept of matrescence. And I would like you to define that, because I obviously I've had a baby. I've said that before, but I've never come across this term in any book that I read. I've heard the fourth trimester, you know, but Alyssa and I were talking about this, how the fourth trimester kind of assumes that it's going to be something that you just get through and then you're going to go back to yourself, or then you're going to, you know, it'll be easier. Whereas matrescence, as you define it in your book, really summed up the mother's experience so much better.
Good. I'm so glad. And I do, I find that concept is so powerful, and in no way, like I did not coin this phrase, matrescence. You know, it's been around since a medical anthropologist, Dr. Raphael in the 70s coined this phrase, matrescence. But language is powerful, right? And I think it does like help us have such a deeper, better understanding. But so in my words, and what I think is the most important about matrescence, and what you just even hit on when you were like setting up this question, was it is maternal adolescence. Here I'm being very visual. you know, and so we think about adolescence, right? And this time is filled with like change and like identity development, and it is this shift that we all expect and prepare for. But when we don't have a word or like an expectation, a social expectation that development, change, identity shifting is happening, when it comes to motherhood, we can feel like something is wrong. And you nailed it when you said, when are we going back? And that really is this assumption that like having children is just an event and instead of it really being life altering. And that sounds so drastic, you know, but again, we would never look at an 18 year old and say, why don't you act like your 12 year old self? Like, when are you going to be 12 again? But we do this to mothers all the time. And again, we do it to ourselves because it is this you know, social narrative. And so I think that that's what's so powerful about having this word and using it, like you say, the fourth trimester being a thing or like an event, and instead recognizing that it is a stage and it is a development that is occurring. And, you know, I say this a lot, and I'll probably hit on this again when we talk about, but that we aren't going back. We're in the process of becoming, and that we are, the more that we can open ourselves, and this is outside of, you know, maternal experiences, open ourselves up to the idea that, like, we're always developing and changing. Like, I hope that I'm not the same person that you thought I was when I was 30. Like, I hope that I have new ideas and new dreams and new life experiences, but we often don't have kind of like the language and the culture around that. It's very much like, well, this is who you are and this is what you should be. And so you had a kid, but keep doing those things. So there, I kind of unpacked a lot about matrescence, but yeah.
That was probably my favorite part of the book, because my oldest just turned 7, and I can't tell you the guilt I still feel from after he was born, because I went into such a bad state of postpartum depression.
Yeah.
And I still feel like I wasn't a good mom then. I was too selfish then. I was too many of these things. But really, it's becoming a new person when you said that. And it's still becoming a new person, right? And then when I had my second and he's 3, it's like, oh, I have to be a completely new person after this. Mm-hmm. And also, as like a middle school teacher, right? I'm seeing that adolescent change. I'm seeing all these things happen. So when you made that connection in your book, I'm like, oh no, I'm one of my 12-year-olds. That's scary. But it like made sense, because I am not that person. And now I can say, like, I'm good with that, because I would never give up my children for anything. But like, I wish someone had just been like, it's okay. This is hard. And I love one of your things. I love that you swear in your book, because this whole idea of going back, you're like, going back is bullshit. This isn't going to happen. So let's stop feeding this idea to the masses and let moms know it's okay to have these emotions, to not call it a trimester. To me, a trimester is like, I'll be done in 12 weeks with this.
Yep.
And then I hit this first birthday. I'm like, this is a really long 12 weeks.
And so, now I'm in the toddler years, and it's like I'm still going through that same like constant transition of like, oh, this is a new thing I have to try to grapple with now. But yeah.
Well, and it was crazy to me. I was telling my mom all about your book on a walk we took, and I told her about this idea, and she's like, oh, I never heard of that either. And I'm like, how the hell are we letting generations of women go through this? And this has been around what feels like forever.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, if we learn about it now, we can keep passing it down to more generations. And I just felt like it's such a vital piece. Okay. And I'm on my soapbox.
No, go ahead.
Bring it.
Do it. Relating that back to like your 6-week checkup.
Oh my God. Like, let's talk about that for a minute.
I wish someone had said that during my 6-week checkup, instead of being, sorry, world. Okay. You're good for sex now. Like, I haven't slept in weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, wish someone would just be like, this is what we call a new identity. It's okay. Your body's healing okay. How are you emotionally? Instead of like some checklist. Yeah. Nope. Your numbers don't add up. It's not postpartum. It's not this.
Yeah.
Everything stopped bleeding. You're fine.
Mm-hmm. Right. So going back to what this concept of matrescence is, where it's like you're like disassociating yourself from this experience, first of all, because you're like, the doctors know what's going on. They'll tell me what I need to know. I was too trusting. I was completely just too like, if it's important, they'll tell me. And I had such an imposter syndrome during this period of what's supposed to be really empowering, this like this encounter of a new identity. And I don't know if it was like a performance thing. Like, I had a really good pregnancy. Great. I checked that off. That was successful. I had what you could consider a really good birth. Great. I did that successfully. And then you're left with like this baby, a spouse who like, you don't really know how to get them on board with what you need their help with. And you're completely confused. And then you go back to the 6-week appointment. Mm-hmm. And at no point did she ask me anything about myself other than like, how's your bleeding? And I remember leaving that appointment feeling like I had been like punched in the face. Like it was never a time for discussion. And great, you're ready to have sex. End of story. Bye. We'll see you again.
I know.
Whatever. And you just feel so lost. Yeah. And like we were reading this book, we're like, we need to give this to everyone we know. And then you feel like you're doing something wrong. Like, I prepped for pregnancy. I prepped for labor.
Yes.
Where's and obviously we are such planners. So when there's not really there, you can't plan for this. You really can't. You can read every book and you will still feel unprepared. And your book really, really just validates that experience, which was so important. We're completely missing that from the discussion.
What I think is so nice, and I mean, I appreciate it. Well, there's kind of two pieces. One, I've had a lot of thought about, is this accessible before you have the baby? And I've had a couple people that have given it to people who are first-time parents and they haven't had the baby yet. And they've had some kind of intense reactions to some of the content in the book, mm-hmm. specifically the chapter about how you're changing relationship with your partner. That's pretty mm-hmm. hard to hear when you haven't lived through it. When you've lived through it, you're yes. kind of like, oh my God, thank God I'm not alone. But when you haven't lived through it and you hear that that's maybe coming, that can put you a little bit defensive. But I think that there's a lot in the book that I'm really validating some of these really hard experiences. And I think before you've experienced them, I've always wondered of saying like, don't read it until you're like actually sitting there holding your baby, because I don't know how they'll sit. But I have had some interesting people or some interesting responses of folks say that they appreciated it, you know, nonetheless before. But I think that the no space for the discussion, and I am loving that, like, since I, you know, did my dissertation and have really been in this world for 10 years now, the change even on kind of like the political front, like we're talking about maternal health care on the like presidential debate stage. That is phenomenal. Like, that was not happening 10 years ago. You know, things like that, and seeing that it is changing and that there's a lot of traction around recognizing that, like, we need to follow up with moms better. We need to change the conversation. And I'm happy and hopeful that, you know, this book can be part of that. But I mean, there's so many more people saying that as well along with me. But yeah, I think that that is exactly it, is to validate that and like have that conversation and the kind of feeling dismissed at that 6-week checkup is so common. And you know, yeah, the checkup has everything to do with safety for like physical, like sexual activity, and nothing to do with like emotional mm-hmm. or, you know, even like relationally ability mm-hmm. to like engage. But again, talk about like disassociation and detachment and what do I exist for? Oh, it's cool. I can be a sexual being again. But what about like how I'm feeling? Oh, it's just awful. And so many folks echo that experience. Yeah.
And that's so, so true with just the idea of your identity changing and your roles being two different things now. So besides the doctors and you're getting that feedback from it, just besides what you're already considering your daily life now changing, I mean, motherhood is sometimes viewed as another role we take on in life, something that we can hop in and out of.
Yeah.
But this is kind of that continuing conversation of what really happens to a person when a birth takes place.
Yeah. 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 And really, like, how do we make space for that transition and for that conversation? And I think that that is what is absence is, you know, you guys kind of mentioned it when we were first talking too, is the, you know, when we go over, how's the baby? And it's so safe to talk about the baby, but, you know, is it even, and I say that in the book too, is I think that like, we're the ones that have to be responsible for changing these difficult dialogues. And I think one of my favorite examples, which I don't know if it's communicated as well in text, is, a friend of mine, there's a group, you know, two moms are standing and talking at the preschool, and a third kind of mom walks up and she's got the baby in the carrier, right? So a pretty little one, and says, hey, how's it going? Right? And like that safe conversation is fine. Everything's fine. And instead, for some reason, this mom's walls were down and she goes, ugh, you know, kind of really hard, actually, or whatever. I can't remember exactly what she said. And the other mom just looked at her and was like, oh my God, thank you for saying that. Like, she was like, thank you for saying that it's like hard and you're having a bad day. And
it's real talk
yeah.
right now.
And it really just like brought some of those walls down. And like, we just, I think that the more that we can do that, you know, and the more that like a text like mine and so many others that can say, that idea is bullshit. And like, let's keep challenging that. And like, let's keep pushing back on these narratives that are really, really detrimental. They're really hurting us and they're disconnecting us from each other, you know?
Mm-hmm. And what I can say from my experience is that I'm not a mom.
Right.
You know, like, so in this point where I know my friends are going through this shift in roles or added on roles to who they are, what can I do as someone who is not a mom, just that supportive aunt figure?
Yeah.
What can I do for them? What's a number one thing that you hear people say that they just need? Because I just hear, you know, I just need some support. But for me, it's particular for each person.
Yeah.
So in general, what do you kind of hear as far as support that women need after birth?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question. I love that. Oh, let's see. I do. I mean, I think you nailed it. I think it's unique for each person. You know, and I would say anything that probably challenges, like, this is terrible, but like, assume that she's probably feeling guilty that she's not back. And I'm putting that in air quotes, you know, I know we're in audio here, but like, feeling that she's not back and not able to be that friend that she was before. And so it's like, I think if I can approach that situation with a friend that's saying, that's not my expectation of you. And instead, I'm wanting to get to know this version of you. I think the biggest thing that I hear again and again is like the practical help. Of literally, you know, the friend just saying like, hey, what's a good time? Like, when does the baby go down for a nap? And I can keep an eye on a nap so you can take a shower and like, hey, just want to sit around and talk. Like, that's my like low expectation of you. I don't want you to go out with me on a Friday night anymore.
Right.
That's not where you're at right now, but I want to be with you in this new developing role and identity and like meet you where you are. And I recognize that. And so I don't know, I would say staying away from anything that feels like that you're contributing also to like that kind of shame or guilt narrative of going back, being somebody else. You're not doing it enough. I've lost my friend, right? Like those things.
Yeah. And I love that too, because it just popped up in my mind. Like, I'm not as a support structure here. I'm not just helping my friend go into a new role as a mom. I'm just trying to transition seamlessly as this is what our friendship looks like now. And that is beautiful.
Yeah.
And this is what I am to you as a friend now. And I'm happy to do that. But it's just the making sure the communication is open and make sure you break that shell of this is not a guilt trip. I'm just here because I love you.
Yeah.
Like, let's break through this together. I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that insight. That's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
I would also say on the flip side, for all you new moms, just take it.
Yeah.
Because I remember...
Huge.
On this walk with my mom, we're talking about your book. And after I had my second, there was this time my grandma, my aunt, my mom, they all came over. They had all the fixins for tacos. They had made me several frozen meals.
Yes.
And I should have just like sat there and eaten my heart out and let someone else hold the baby. But I could not stop and think about, oh, I should be cleaning their dishes right now. I should be helping clean this. And like, it's like, we also do it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have this idea, we still need to keep doing it all. And there are people who want to help. I really needed help with the cooking. I couldn't keep up and like feed people and do all this. But I know in that moment, the guilt that I was still not being enough and like being a good hostess.
Yes.
just it ate me up. And now I look back and I'm like, you guys can come over anytime and feed me. Why was I being crazy then? But it just, I could not let go of the idea of I'm not doing enough for my guest right now.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's such a performative time. You know, you have people over. It's like you have this new baby. You want to look like you're in control. Like you have this down. Because here's the generation of women before you who raised you and they did it just fine. And you're like, I can barely, you know, do two things at once anymore. And.
Well, and I would pause and really say... Like, even right there is, like, and I think, so I talk so much about social construction, right? And, like, that is so common that the generation before us did it just fine. No, I call bullshit. No, they did not. They were not just fine. And I think that that's actually really, really important. You know, I think that they had different social structures and they had different responsibilities. And I think that they had their challenges, too. And just like we're having this conversation right now, they have stuff that... that wasn't talked about then, and many of them still refuse to talk about, just because you just mm-hmm. didn't, right? And that is a socially constructed idea that these are off-topic topics, you know? And so I think that even just pushing back on that, that it might have appeared so, and that might have been the story that we wanted to tell, they wanted to tell. But I think that the more that we can be like, no, they had some hard times too. And that things were not, and this idea that things were ever easy in like these extremely dependent little people needing us to survive. I think that idea is so common. And I think that that's part of where we do compare ourselves to that and go, oh, well, my mom, and she could do it all. And, you know, I don't know whether or not your mom will be honest, be like, oh, yeah, no, I was in the closet and I was having hitting a drink or I was crying, you know, but mm-hmm. but they had their stuff, too. And I think the more that we can, I don't know, push back against even like that idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I call this imperfect help.
And I really love this, at that moment. Like, is that Amanda is in a closet right now recording remotely.
Well, and like, I think it is. That's what's funny too. But, and what is, this is one, I mean, you can choose to edit this out or not, but like our kind of like mommy wine culture is a really interesting culture, right? Of like how much we promote. The only way I saw a meme yesterday. I love memes. I saw a meme the other day and it was the, you know, the wine and spirits section of the grocery store. And it was like, get back to school supplies here, right? Like we have this thing, which in some ways is very humorous and gives us this outlet to kind of like joke about. But like our moms didn't have that as a joke, but that doesn't mean our moms weren't hitting the sauce and maybe just not telling people about, mm-hmm. you know? And like, there's a whole lot about like how we have made certain things socially acceptable rather than just being like, this is really, really fucking hard. you know? And so I just think that that's interesting. And I'm sorry, I kind of interrupted you, but I just thought that was a good example of like those ideas of what we think something should be like. And I'm putting should in quotes mm-hmm. again. So
you think of like imposter syndrome, which, you know, obviously is what our podcast is all about, but the multiple layers of imposter syndrome you are experiencing in that moment.
Yeah.
Because like my example was an imposter syndrome. I'm not being a good enough host.
Yes.
But yes. Then there's the motherhood imposter syndrome. Then there, well, this is my mom and grandma. There's like this family imposter right. syndrome, and there's, like, the list just keeps going on and on. So even when you're like, no, it's okay, let them do it, there's like 10 other things in your yeah. head that are just piling on. And I like how you just keep saying we have to change the narrative, because mm-hmm. that only gets in your head and it only piles up because there's these narratives from everywhere. And if you're not getting it from people, then you're getting it from technology and social media and all the stupid Instagram posts. Pictures. They're not yeah. stupid, but they...
No, I get what you're saying.
It's someone wants to post a cute picture of their yeah. baby, and you're like, that's cuter than the picture I took of my baby. Are they not going to grow up with cute baby pictures? Like,
yeah. Oh no.
Yes.
It's even like the little things. Intense. There's so much guilt sometimes.
It's intense. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I talk about it like the gift of imperfect help is like if somebody shows up to a baby shower and they bought you, you know, some crib sheets and shit, you say, thank you, I'm grateful. And I think if we can think about our people, whoever our people are, as you define them, showing up for us and whatever that looks like, whether that in your case example was like making a meal, and we can say, thank you, I'm really grateful. And then like sit down and shut up and take the gift. You know, and I think that that's the part mm-hmm. that's so hard is trying to kind of get out of our head and just say, if this came wrapped up with a bow, like that cute little outfit they got me, I would never say, oh, no, no. You know, and that's one of the ways that I try to like help us think about it. Like it's a gift and just say thank you. And sometimes you have to chant mm-hmm. that in your head.
So if I can, I was going to transition it to a new topic too. I love the title of your book. It's just so simply put, Dear Mama, You Matter. And I know something that was a struggle for me was that transition in the relationship with your partner. Because you rely on your partner so much for support during that time, and you already had like this, hopefully a basis with your partner to go into parenting with, but it's a whole new world. Mm-hmm. I know with my husband and I, it was like, who are you? Mm-hmm. What are we doing? Like, I've known you how long? And it's not to say he was like bad right. during that time. He was very supportive, yep. but all the things I needed were not the things I had ever needed before.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to say it because I was like, I don't know what I need. Mm-hmm. So can you just explain to us, like, why is it so important to recognize this transition between you and your partner and be open and respective towards each other during this experience?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Really, and like, you know, echoing here what we're talking about so much is that, like, recognizing that we are all, our partners too, are ever evolving, right? And I suppose I'm kind of going to go on a tangent here for a second, but really just back to this idea of, you know, identity and kind of development and even this matrescence, is that I think we have this concept that we arrive somewhere at like some developmental destination. Like, let's arguably say like that's when you're 18 or maybe when you get out of college, if you go to college or whatever, you know, and then you have your degree and you're like, I have arrived, right? Like, I am done at becoming this person that I will be. I am there, period, end of sentence. And instead, the more that we can open up and realize that all of us, like, as humans are constantly in the process of developing and changing, you know, and so both you and your partner are going through, those types of identity shifts and changes. And as long as we can like be rooted in this idea of, you know, becoming as an active verb, I think we can have more like patience and grace and understanding with each other. And I think like Madeline, like you were asking of how can I support a friend? And you really like summarized that mm-hmm. when you were saying, and I think the same is really true of partners, is like, how can we continue to discover like who we are now, like who we are in this moment? And I think that if we meet each other with this genuine sense of like curiosity, like, how has this changed you? What are you discovering about yourself? And then there's also, obviously, like, the practical sides of things. But I think that this, like, you know, this benign and kind of benevolent assumption about our partners, neither one of us are in this to hurt each other. We're just trying to figure this all out and really approach that with curiosity and saying, like, I'm discovering things about myself and you are. And it's a lot right now. And I think that that can be helpful in how we approach those times and how we really try to like see each other through it and kind of grow and become together. 'Cause the relationship is changing too.
Okay. So further in your book, you discuss the transition into your new identity that comes with loss because you go through the 7 stages of grief where we might've heard it in passing or even in a good old meme as we referenced before. But what does this really look like for new moms and how do we navigate that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is huge. And I would say specifically like working with clients, with perinatal clients, probably one of the more profound things I would say like we hit on was like understanding matrescence has been really huge for folks. And then like linking this idea of loss and really like mourning and grief, because that is not what people want to think about when they think about becoming a parent. And as soon as I think that we can label that and kind of raise our consciousness to that and honor the need to kind of grieve and the need to look at like some losses, I think that it can be really impactful in kind of going through this transition. So I would say that that is probably one of the second most like powerful things that people have. I published that chapter on loss early kind of in leading up to the book being released, and it was pretty well received in a wide, you know, kind of some wider audiences really picked that up. I'll call it like viral for me. This has this little following, you know, but because so many people were like, oh my gosh, wow, that is what this is. I didn't really realize that I had some grief here. Like I had some mourning to do. And so I think right. that when we can own that and like make that connection, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it was, because as I was reading this section, I'm looking at these 7 stages. And I literally had a memory for each one of those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had never associated or connected those two different, I guess, areas of psychology, the 7 stages of grief. You kind of just only associate that right. with a literal loss of a friend or
right,
family
yeah.
member.
Right, right.
But here we are experiencing... I'm sorry, I'm kind of jumbling, but it's just a lot. It's like you give birth and you don't really realize that while this is a period of excitement and you wanted this, there is such a loss that comes with it. And I think the earlier that we can understand that and be, I guess we can't be ready for it, but really, like, I guess expect that that's going to be a
you're going to acknowledge that it will be a factor of life.
Exactly. That I think would have such a powerful impact on women and even their partners' mental health during this process. That was huge for me.
Well, and what I really want to, like, to come from that idea, and I'm glad that that was so helpful for you, but, like, what I hope and what I say is, like, there's never a situation that I can think of that, like, having more, like, self-compassion and, like, grace, giving yourself more grace would ever be wrong. Like, that is, like, always the answer. And so I think that here's my scene, if you will. Like, I'm imagining maybe this happened in my life, like, right, I've got, and I don't think I stated that I have, my children are 12 and a half now and 8 and a half. So I have a seventh grader and a third grader in my life. And I can imagine when they were pretty little and I have gone through all of the scrambling to get the diaper bags and the thing. And it took us 30 minutes to get out the house. And I am like, I know we need to get out the house and I am exhausted. And I am like, I don't even know who I am. I can't complete my thoughts. The kid blew out his diaper. Of course, I didn't have a diaper in the diaper bag. All of these things, right? And I'm sitting in the parking lot of wherever I was going. And I just feel like, who am I? How did I get here? And not only that, but I'm clearly failing at this task, right? Like, I'm just overwhelmed. And I start to cry in the parking lot. Like, I have the moment and I just am like, and breaking point. And I think that if we can look at that and I can say, that's okay. Like, it's okay that you don't feel like yourself. Like, it's okay that this is hard. Like, it's expected. Like, and I can have more self-compassion and more grace and even, yeah, expectation that this is normal to have those moments instead. And so, right, the alternative would be that I'm going to beat myself up. I'm going to go into that guilt and shame narrative and I'm going to say, you're a failure. You should have never had kids. You should have never, right, blah, 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 spiral the Dane. Mm-hmm. And instead, if I can sit there, have my cry and be like, yep, that was a hard one. I really don't like it when I can't do things with ease and this is hard. And I can, like, have that compassion and that grace with myself. I think that that's where the power lies of just like, I just need a moment. I need to mourn this. I need to cry about this. And that's okay.
I think it's important for people who are trying to support us too, to understand that we're going through that mourning process, because I feel like there's a lot of, I don't know how to explain it. I breastfed both my sons for a little bit, but breastfeeding was very hard for me because I felt like it was a loss of freedom.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Because you're always attached to this baby. Sure. And I remember getting comments like, well, at least you can breastfeed. Yes, I'm thankful for that.
Oh,
but
my,
like,
gosh.
Same thing. I can remember being at Target. And, like, I'm like, I got 20 minutes before the next feeding. Let's get in there. And the baby wants the feeding right now. And sitting there crying, like, I just want to go into a store. I don't need anything. I want to smell some candles. I just want to go in. But it is that I'm mourning what I can't have. It doesn't mean I'm not thankful for the baby.
Absolutely.
And this example, breastfeeding or different things like that. But I think if you are near a new mom and you have to understand that mourning period and not try to give it, like, that positive spin.
Yeah. Yes.
Because sometimes you just got to be sad.
Yes, toxic positivity.
You got to acknowledge it for what it is.
Yeah. What I will say, and I do talk about this in the book too, but, like, that right there is such a good example of where I like to say, I think a good tool for us is to be able to say, and instead of, like, but. And so, like, we would say something, like, for example, right, like, you know, I'm breastfeeding, but I know I should just be so thankful, right? Or so we'll put the but in there. And then if I can say, I'm breastfeeding and it's really exhausting and I'm really happy that I'm able to do that. Like, all of those things are true. So by changing it to, like, an and, we're, like, allowing all of those realities to, like, coexist in their mucky, messy, muddiness. So sometimes I think that changing that and can be powerful because we're, like, allowing space for those instead of trying to silence ourselves with the butt. And also, again, you said it, this is very a social thing of what others say.
You stole our next point off the outline because literally we're talking about mutually exclusive emotions in motherhood. I'm like, she got it. We're good.
On top of it.
Fellow charlatan.
That's amazing.
That was very eye-opening. There are so many things in your book, just like understanding the science behind it. I know we keep saying this, but like that can be applied to things outside of motherhood. Yes. Even just reading about the 7 stages of like mourning and grief, I'm like, I've never even heard of that. That can apply to so many other things I've experienced in life. So even if you're listening right now and you're not a mom, there are just like things we're talking about. I was like, holy cow, why don't we know this in the world? And it's so applicable to so many different things, especially this
idea.
Yeah,
it's just a specialty concept.
Yeah, you can have 2 opposite emotions at the same time, and that is totally okay.
Yeah, and I think that that's just it. The more that I can recognize that and do that in my friendships and change the talking from saying, but at least you can breastfeed, instead of saying, oh, yeah, mama, it's hard. Boom, I just gave you space to be able to be like, thank you for allowing me to have these complex emotions right now. And that can mean the world, right? And you're right, it applies to so much outside of motherhood and parenthood. Absolutely, yeah. And I think maybe this is a good segue for or kind of a related topic, is this idea of also about when we're saying the but, or we're saying should, really, this activates this anxiety cycle in our brain. And so here I'm going to get kind of like technical and like kind of some of the science-y stuff, but I like that part. And thank you for saying that I blended that well, because that was like my whole goal. So thank you. But what happens is my brain, my kind of primitive like lizard brain, if you will, that operates in this like fight, flight, freeze, survive mode, hears the phrase should. It hears the phrase, but I should be, or it's supposed to, or I'm supposed to be being a good host. And it goes, uh-oh, something's wrong, right? I mean, that's ultimately kind of what that message says. And so what that self-talk can do is really activate that stress response, that anxiety response cycle in that kind of primitive part of our brain that starts sending off these alarm bells that says, something's wrong, danger, danger, danger. And it can kind of really start that anxiety spiral. And so it is amazing how powerful, you know, just tending to our language, you know, and like I said, that self-compassion and the grace that's saying, you know, and this is just really hard and that's okay, you know, can help, or really catching when we're saying that something should be. Rather than saying, well, I would really like to do that right now, is very different than saying, oh, I should. You know, so there's some real power in that language and in that self-talk and kind of breaking that anxiety stress cycle.
We, like, rationally, we understand that there's no such thing as this perfect mom. I know you brought up earlier, you're comparing your experiences to seeing mothers post pictures of their kids on Instagram that are just these perfect things. And you get this assumption about that parent that, oh, they have it all under control. That's such a damaging mentality to have about ourselves, but it's also very American. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's, you mentioned in your book, it's this concept that really has been fed down from the top of this rugged individual of being wholly self-reliant. And I think that really, really comes to play in motherhood, that I have to do this all myself. I'm in charge, right? Biologically, I birthed this child. It's reliant on me so much in those first, obviously like the first year of its life. How do we actually disengage, though, from this perfect mom construct to better embrace what you call in your book the good enough mom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have to, of course, give a shout out to Dr. Winnicott, who actually coined that phrase, right, the good enough mother. Yeah, well, there's a lot that you just talked about there, all related. You know, I guess I would say, yeah, the first thing that we have to do is like recognize that we have this narrative, right? Like recognize the concept of the rugged individual. And really, I think one of the best ways to put this is the bootstrap argument. I mean, that's what that is, and like how much that is like embedded into our culture and how we have internalized that, and that we favor independence, you know, above all else. And when we can look around and see how we are kind of prioritizing that, like at what cost, and just see that. And then I think that first step is like, as we recognize that, that gives us the opportunity to go, are there other ways that we can think about these things? And I will say, you know, from like an evolutionary psychology perspective, we evolved in groups. Like, we are social beings, and I cannot emphasize that with enough, like, bold and underlined in my lecture notes. Like, we are social beings. We need other people. And so that is where if we recognize that, we can see how really damaging that idea of the rugged individual and the doing it all ourselves is so damaging. And if we can look for community, and I think really speaking to what you were mentioning earlier, Elise, of like, and then allow them in, that we really can thrive, you know. And so I think maybe to the charlatans, as this concept of saying like, oh, I do not have my shit together, and in fact, I'm not supposed to have my shit together. That is why I exist in community and have other people. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that we can actually acknowledge that and say that, and it allows us to open the door and see ways that we, you know, can rely on each other and stop with that damaging cycle.
Can you share maybe some ways for new moms, any moms, to kind of create community for themselves? Yeah. Because when I had my first, I was 23 and I was the first out of all my yep. friends. And I didn't realize I had friends. I thought I had community. I didn't realize I needed my mom community. Yeah. But as an introvert, I struggled to find community. So can you give like maybe some like ideas or tips or tricks for our listeners to kind of create that for themselves?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, we keep repeating, but that very first thing is recognizing that you need it. And I actually really tried to honor this in the book because I don't really identify as being like introverted in kind of the traditional sense that we think about it. I'm not going to even get into that. But I recognize how many people are and like how often I hear that. And so I really tried to honor that and talk about how to make friends even when you're an introvert. But I think that the first thing is exactly what you said, is saying like, oh, I need friends. And I think so, therefore, looking for those opportunities and saying, if I need this outcome and I know that it benefits me to have a community of friends that are also, you know, maybe parents that are at a similar age, then I'm going to push myself like outside of my limits a little bit. And of course you have to define for ourselves like what those limits are. But the thing is, if we stay at home and go, I need mom friends, but you refuse to go to the music class, or you refuse to try the mom group, or we refuse to, you know, even hang out after the class. And one of the quotes in the book is like, you know, you're hanging out by the diaper bags acting like you're going to hit on somebody, like dating, you know, but it's true. Like, it is that awkward. And I think just like dating, we had to choose that, like, we wanted to be in a relationship. So we had to push through some of those awkward things. And I think that that's part of it, is looking for opportunities, join online communities. If somebody tries to adopt you as an introvert, be willing to try that on, you know, things like that, you know, can be helpful. But we just have to say, okay, this is a valuable outcome. And even though I'm uncomfortable in this moment, the other side of this can have some real kind of like benefits and some real fruits. So sticking with it. And again, that's true outside of motherhood, I think, is not trying to become an extrovert, but recognize that there's good on the other side of pushing through some of those things.
Well, this was probably, I don't know, this is a great conversation. I'm very excited to actually like go back and listen to this. But I just want to say thank you so much to Dr. Amanda Hardy for being willing to be literally our first guest and quite the guinea pig, and just really talk to us about a topic that is so near and dear to our hearts, because we are parents, or because we love people in our lives who are parents, or we, you know, maybe you want to become a parent someday. This is such valuable information. And like you said, Alyssa, really frankly is relevant to a lot of other areas of our lives as well. But Dr. Amanda Hardy's book is called Dear Mama, You Matter. Madeline, you can tell us where to find that.
Oh yeah. What I really, really loved about Amanda's email to us is that she's like, she likes to encourage bookshop.org, so you can find a local bookstore that will carry it or that will order it for you. So then you can support a small local business that way. I love that. She said it is also available through Amazon if you don't have access to a local bookstore near you. But I also want to take a minute to say, hey, Amanda, pitch us your social handles real quick. And I'm sure you have a website.
Sure. Yep. You can find me on like Instagram and Facebook. Amanda Hardy LMHC or Amanda Hardy PhD.com. Instagram is the Amanda Hardy LMHC, and my website's just Amanda Hardy PhD.
So go ahead and follow Amanda. She's obviously doing such important work right now. Buy a book, buy five, hand them out like we've been doing. But what we love to do with our ending of our podcast is we like to talk about what we're smelling in the room because we're candle obsessed. And hey, Amanda, what candle are you smelling right now?
You guys, I forgot to light my candle.
Make it up.
No, it's fine. You're in a closet. Don't light it.
Don't light it. Just tell us your favorite candle. Just tell us.
I can't remember the name of it. I think it's Red Fern from Wax Buffalo.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. Hey, look at you. I will take this.
Like, I'm going to go Google that.
She's about to librarian this so hard. But the thing is, like we said, mentioned before, Amanda is recording remotely in the closet. So we would have been lying anyway if she was actually smoking it because we
do not want a fire hazard.
She's just in her recording closet for the pandemic and I'm remote. Ladies, like, hey, we're living it. We're trying to provide an authentic experience. So here it is right on the table. But what's also good about... first-time authors or authors who are starting to really make their mark in the world, leave a review if you love their books. Oh, so Goodreads, on so Google, on Amazon. Yeah, it makes a big difference with how they pop up. And sometimes just because you don't have a social following or you weren't an influencer, sometimes your book doesn't get seen no matter how valuable the content is. So if you read this book, if you love this book, review it. Same as a good, lovely tie-in to our podcast too. Same thing there. It's like, we always say review on Apple, but it's the same thing with books. So Elise, do you want to talk about where people can get in contact with us?
All right, guys, you can find us on Instagram at Charlatans Pod or Facebook. Just search the Charlatans Podcast. And then lastly, of course, our Gmail, charlatanspod@gmail.com.
And thank you so much for listening, guys. We would love to hear your feedback. We would love to hear your stories if you related with anyone here. And we will catch you on the next listen.